an FBI investigator or a police officer can look at art critically, and it can enhance the way they do their job. We use art as a vehicle to rethink how we ask questions. What are we seeing? What are we not seeing? What's missing? What did I expect to happen? What didn't happen? Art makes us comfortable with being present in a different way. If I had a dime for every time somebody came up to me after a session and said, you know, this is going to help me with my work, but oh my God, I think about how I haven't been listening to my wife or how I've been observing my relationship in a certain way for 20 years. This is changing and how I'm going to engage in my world.
Hey you, welcome to the Art and Happiness Project, the podcast about the transformative powers of art on our health, our mind, our relationship, and on society. In this show, I speak with artists from all categories, but also business leaders, scientists, and experts. We have challenging and moving conversations about the many ways in which art can change our lives, maybe even change the world. Why not? So, what do the FBI, the NYPD, Department of Homeland Security, many US hospitals, Johnson & Johnson, Planned Parenthood, and a group of nuns have in common? It is today's guest, and she is called Amy Herman. Amy is a lawyer and an art historian turned expert on seeing. And for 14 years, she's been providing art-based leadership training to top officers in the United States military, law enforcement, medicine, education, and industry. In her Art of Perception seminars and programs, Amy shows people how to look closely at painting, sculpture, and photography. She teaches them to see what's missing, see what's hidden or underrated, see from somebody else's eyes. Amy uses artworks to make people look again, think better, and be better. She developed her Art of Perception seminar in 2000 to improve medical students' observation and communication skills with their patients when she was at the head of education at the Frick Collection in New York City. She then adapted the program for a wide range of professionals and leads sessions now internationally for a very impressive, official, and powerful list of clients. Amy and I hit it off. We talked about her job with FBI officers and executives alike, but also with more surprising groups of people. We discussed the power of learning to look very closely and how that makes us better at our jobs, but also in our lives. And we talked about observing, and observing art in particular as a meditation, as an act of presence and of patience in a very fast-spinning world. And then, logically, we kind of landed talking about the use of our time on Earth, about life, death, and the place of art in all of that. I loved all of it. I hope you do too. Enjoy. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you so much for speaking with me. It's a pleasure.
Very happy to be here.
So, I guess I wanted to start the interview by really just asking you, how does one go from being a lawyer to teaching CIA agents, crime scene investigators, and Navy SEALs to be better observers through looking at art?
It's actually, my answer comes from self-perception. Knowing what we don't want to do with our lives is just as important as knowing what we want to do. And while I was trained as a lawyer, not only did I not like being a lawyer, I knew where my heart was. I had an aha moment when I studied art history in undergraduate, but yet I didn't want to waste my training as a lawyer. And I thought, well, how can I combine the practical aspects of each of those disciplines, legal analysis and visual analysis, to create something not only that's of interest to me, but it's useful to other people? And that's how I created the Art of Perception, combining my love of art with the practicality of being a lawyer and being able to reach people who wouldn't necessarily think about looking at art as part of their work.
Right, because I mean, it's funny, I also went to law school and I also studied art history after that. I kind of had the reverse. I finished law school, but halfway through I thought, you know, this is not for me and I need to go into art. My point being, there was a lot of lawyers and law students around me, still in my friends groups by the time I studied art history, that just didn't relate to art at all. And for me, it was the most exciting challenge to see a group of people, a lot of which were my very close friends and still are, and try to make it interesting to them.
Yes.
And not something remote.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. But I thought, you know, after going through all this legal training and I had a number of jobs and I thought, there has to be, in my own world, I didn't consider myself a creative person. I said, let me try to be creative to combine the two. And over a number of years, and when I left the law to go work in a museum, that's where I had the venue and the resources to put this idea into action.
So What is the idea?
The idea is actually quite simple when I explain it. The idea is that art is very powerful. We know that art is powerful, but often it's just powerful to those who understand it or are schooled in it. And what I try to do in the art of perception is channel that power of art and bring it to people in professions who wouldn't think about looking at art as part of their day-to-day work, like nurses and FBI investigators and police chiefs. And what I do is I look at the works of art through the lens of an art historian. And I think, well, what are the issues that are facing in these very difficult times? And I match the concept to the work of art, and I bring a presentation to them that's engaging, that's thought-provoking, and most important, eye-opening to the idea that they can look at art critically and it can enhance the way they do their job without having to have a degree or even an understanding of who Picasso is or who Manet is. That's not relevant. It's how we look, how we engage, and most importantly, how do we communicate what we see? And so I use art as the vehicle to be able to do that.
I love that idea, by the way, of the art historical context around, you know, who the artist is and what are the dates becomes completely irrelevant, because I think that's what makes it dull to a lot of people who are not naturally interested in it in the first place. And so say, you know, forget about how important it is, forget even about it being good or bad art, forget about the judgment of value around it, but let's see what it can do for you is very powerful. I guess a question that I'm asking myself is, what are the common ways, I suppose, we all fail to observe enough, right? Because that's what you're teaching through art, right? It's observation. So how are we not good at this on a daily basis?
Well, I'll give you two examples. First one is a museum example and one is a real life example. In the museum, when those of us who visit museums or galleries, when we go to look at art, the first thing we do usually is read the label and say, who painted this? You know, when was it done? And we put it in a context. And when I bring my participants into a museum, they're not allowed to read the labels. And I want to encourage their own sense of inherent observation. And so what I do with a group of people, whether it's a group of students or a group of doctors or a group of police officers, is that we go into a museum gallery and I say, look around. If there was one work of art that you could take home with you today, which one would it be? And I ask them to draw upon their own sense of what they're drawn to. And I say to them, well, why do you love this so much? Why are you drawn to it? And it gets them to open up about looking at art without the label, without the context, and frankly, without the inhibition of not knowing anything about it. They're going with their gut. How often do we go with our gut when we have to make decisions or solve problems? And so when we do that in a museum, it takes all the inhibition away. You don't have to know anything to say anything about it. The other thing about observation is it goes back to a bias. You know, when we get good at what we do, we become very myopic. Our vision really narrows. We become laser focused on what we have to do. And people feel comfortable going from point A to point B in their lives, whether it means doing their jobs, raising their children, whatever they do, we go from point A to point B. And what I try to do is ask people to look at points B, C, D, and E. Because I believe that the best things happen on the exit ramp of your comfort zone. So what I do is I take people out of their comfort zone, show them all the things that they can see and some of the things that they're missing, and then I bring them back in. And I say, you know, this isn't going to be scary. We're going to go look at works of art. You're going to see so many things that you didn't see before. And then you're going to go back to your world and you're going to bring what you saw with you to augment what it is that you see and do. And so I remind people, we get into our comfort zones. That's natural. It's what we want to do. But sometimes it's a really good thing to leave your comfort zone knowing that you're going to go back into it.
Yeah. I interviewed recently on the show somebody called Sam Ramos, and he's the director of innovation and creativity at the Art Institute of Chicago. And he does a lot of kind of art talks, the goal of which is to bring people out of their comfort zone. And he calls it, and I think an occupational therapist friend of his calls it guided disorientation.
Yeah, guided disorientation. I love it. But you know, even that title, I have to tell you, can scare people. People don't want to be disoriented. People don't want to be disrupted. You know what? Our lives are disrupted enough. And you know, I did a session yesterday for a group of engineers and designers and environmentalists. And one of them came up to me afterwards. The session was about 2.5 hours of looking at art together, just looking at art together. And he said to me, I have no feeling for art. I don't like it. I go to museums. He said, I have more to think about. It's going to take me days to process everything that I've seen. And that's what I want to hear. Because when we open our eyes and use our brains in a different way, which is what art enables us to do, it opens your eyes to all other possibilities that you had never considered before.
And I also think that art observation is very linked to attention. And it seems to me, I don't know if you would agree, that we have less attention than before. And therefore that we're probably less observant than we used to be. Do you think that's right?
I agree completely. We have very, very short attention spans. And, you know, I point my finger at the pandemic. With the pandemic, I mean, the pandemic has done a lot of things. There have definitely been some good things that have come out of it. But one of them is we are attached to our devices more than ever because our human connectivity has decreased so much in the last 2 years. And when we're attached to our devices, we look for instantaneous replies. If Alexa or Siri can't answer our question fast enough, we just go to the next source. Rather than rethinking, how can we rephrase the question? How can we engage in the conversation? And so, yes, I think our attention spans are much shorter and our patience is diminished. And when you're looking at art, you have no choice but to just, when I say to people, spend 10 seconds looking at this painting, 10 seconds is a long time looking at one thing. And it's amazing what you see when you stop and pause.
But people don't do that anymore.
I'm trying to change that.
Yeah. And so, I mean, give me some examples. For example, I guess I'm going straight to the spies because that's also...
Sure.
I wanted to be a spy once in my life when I was a child. Obviously, I mean, this is an example where attention and observation are key skills. How do you work with those people?
One of the things that I start with, one of the things that's most important is a concept that I call the pertinent negative. And what that means is articulating what you don't see in addition to what you do see to actually give a fuller, more accurate picture of what you're looking at. So when we're looking at a painting, what comes to mind is a painting by Magritte, and it's a painting of a train coming out of a fireplace, and there's smoke or steam coming out of this train. And when I ask these intelligence officials, tell me what you see, they'll say, well, there's a train coming out of a fireplace. And I remind them, did you notice that there are no tracks under the train and there is no fire in the fireplace? And so I encourage them to talk about the pertinent negative, talk about what's not happening, what expectations were not fulfilled. Because when you're looking, when you are an intelligence analyst and you're looking at hostile states and you're looking at behavior, it's not just about what you notice, it's what you don't notice. What are the gaping holes? What are the unanswered questions? That's what analysts do. That's what people who are watching other people and thinking about the behaviors of other people. So we use art as a vehicle to rethink how we ask questions. What are we seeing? What are we not seeing? What's missing? What did I expect to happen? What didn't happen? And so that's how I work with people who are doing investigating, or what we call surveillance, watching for a living.
My name is Joe Navarro, and for 25 years, I was a special agent with the FBI. My job was to catch spies. Espionage work is often nowhere near what we see in movies. And in one of the cases, we had information from another country saying, you have an American we think is actually a mole who somehow entered the United States, is able to pass as an American, but he's here working for a hostile intelligence service. And just fortuitously, he was videographed coming out of a flower shop. We're looking at the video, and everybody in our small unit, we were saying, well, there's not much there. You know, he's coming out of the shop, getting in his car. And I said, stop the film right there. Just as he came out of the shop, he took the flowers, and most Americans tend to hold the flowers by the stalk so that the flowers are up. This individual took them and grabbed the stalk and then held the flowers so that they were facing down. And I said, that's how they carry flowers in Eastern Europe.
I surveyed your very, very long client list. And so there's lots of law firms, of hospitals, of universities even. You also work with commercial corporations. What do you think is the common thing between all of them that they lack and that you bring?
I can tell you one group that you didn't name that really opened my eyes. I went to do my presentation for a group of nuns in a convent.
Wow.
I'll never forget it. It was in 2017. And I remember going, I was, you know, going to their community and they asked me to come speak to them. And I said to the Mother Superior, why are you inviting me here? And she hit the nail on the head for all those groups that you named. She said, when you are in the human business, you need to see as much as possible. And so all of those groups that you named, doctors and lawyers and police officers and trauma surgeons and nuns, what's the common thread is they all are in the people business. And when we're in the people business, there is no going from point A to point B because no two people are the same. And so art gives us this amazing opportunity to look at painting and sculpture and photography to get a better understanding of the human condition. And that's creativity is about the human condition, and all those institutions that you named, what they all have in common is they're all in the people business, including the nuns.
Including the nuns. That's amazing. I mean, that's, I love that you worked with nuns. It's, you know, the very least, the very last group of people I would have thought about.
That's why I had to bring them up, because nobody would ever imagine. And Mother Superior had such vision to bring me in, because even I had to ask the question, what do you hope to get from looking at works of art with me? And she said, we are in the people business.
It's also because, I mean, when you talk about, when you mention nuns, for me, the first thing that also came to mind is that nuns and people in the religious sectors are, meditation is a very kind of important tenet of, not meditation as in, you know, Buddhist meditation or, you know, an app-based meditation,
yeah.
But in general, kind of being present and being in connection to God and spirituality is obviously kind of the central part. And for this, attention is a key tenet of that, right? And so I wonder...
Absolutely.
Right. And I wonder to what extent art is also a support for meditation.
It's a great question. And there's something else that comes to mind about the nuns. When I think of meditation, I think of contemplation. Mm-hmm. And art gives us this wonderful opportunity to contemplate what we're looking at. And for someone like me, who's really not very creative at all, I often look at a work of art and I think, how did the artist make this? How did they create this? What is their sense of inspiration? And while I don't consider myself a religious person, I'm a spiritual person, and I really have a profound respect for creativity. And it's not that far from the contemplative world that these nuns live in. And the other connection is the connectivity that the nuns have to make between their contemplation and their meditation and their service to God and how they serve people. The nuns that I worked with were called the Little Sisters of the Poor, and they served the indigent poor who lived in their building. The nuns lived upstairs, and these very elderly, sick residents lived downstairs. And so I helped them forge stronger connections between their grounding and their serving of the indigent poor. And that's a connection that I make with police officers, how they think about their work and how that translates to their work in the community. Because, you know, we have this disconnect now between police officers and the community, right. And there's such tension. How can we be more mindful about thinking about what we see and how we act accordingly? So what I'm describing to you, what the nuns are doing and what the police officer are doing vis-a-vis art is exactly the same thing. Make sense?
It totally makes sense, and I love that. And what it brings it up to me as you're transitioning also to the police, and also when I think about the police, I also think about the criminal justice systems and generally kind of professions that are in power, because
yes.
I think that we're talking about power here. And therefore, it brings me to the idea of objectivity, and I think that's probably very close to the idea of observation. How much of what you do is about being objective versus freedom of interpretation, right?
Right. Well, let's look at it this way. I ask my participants to look at works of art, which is probably the most subjective thing you could do.
Right.
And I ask them to put them in objective terms so that when we're looking at a work of art, the bottom line is, and I say to my participants, and this takes a level of fear away, I say to them, I don't care whether you like this or not. That's not important to me. What's important to me is what you see. Because in all of our lines of work, We have to be able to say what we see before we say what we think. And so I instill the skills of being objective in being able to say what you see. So if you go back to that Magritte painting that I described before about the train coming out of the fireplace, I don't want someone to look at it and say to me, you know, this painting is weird. Weird doesn't help me. Weird doesn't give me a sense of the visual. But right. if you say to me, well, I'm looking at a painting and it appears to me that there's a train coming out of a fireplace and the smoke or steam is blowing into the chimney, you give me a visual picture without using the word weird or like or dislike. I'm getting a much stronger sense. So it's, as I said, it's important when it comes to de-escalation and when it comes to problem solving to be able to say what we see before saying what we think. And saying what we see is about objectivity. And so I teach people to look at works of art as vehicles to rethink objective communication.
And if from a business standpoint as well, I mean, so far we've talked about very kind of a lot of public services and public functions, but from a private commercial business stand as well, that holds true too. In the business world, communication is still pretty poor, yes. either written or verbal communication, or even what we call nonverbal communication. So all the body languages and all of that. And so talk to me about communication, because we've talked about observing and seeing what's not there and being able to deduce, and how does observing art can then impact how we communicate to the other person with words more effectively?
Here's the example that I'll give you, and it's a real life example, and it's one that I use all the time in my teaching. If you've ever been on a plane that's experienced turbulence, you know, the plane starts
I know that
to
one
balance
well.
And you know it well, right? It happens to all, it happened to me yesterday. So I've noticed two patterns when a plane goes into turbulence. In the first pattern, the plane starts to shake and the pilot will pick up the phone and say, okay, everyone, hi, it's Captain Barbara from the cockpit. I'm picking up the phone to tell you that we're going to have rough air for about 20 minutes. Please fasten your seatbelts. We're going to suspend the beverage service. And if you can please not use the restroom for 20 minutes, I'll get back on and I'll tell you when we're going to make our descent into Heathrow and everything. And she hangs up. And I see what people do. They look at their watches. They take a deep breath. They take the last sip of Chardonnay. They do whatever they have to do to handle the 20. Everyone can handle 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's when the plane goes into turbulence and the plane starts to shake and the bags fall and there's no word from the cockpit. People think they're going to die. They think we're going to crash. And I've had people next to me, you know, dig their fingernails into my arm and they say, oh, has this ever happened to you? And I say, oh, it happens all the time. It's just turbulence. But the difference between when the pilot communicates and when the pilot says nothing is the difference between panic and calmness. It's a whole world. And so I remind my participants, put parameters around a problem, be able to communicate in the simplest terms. You know, the next week is going to be really rough. I'm right here. I'm watching the situation instead of saying nothing. And so by looking at art, I'm encouraging people, as they say in preschool, to use their words because no one's in your head. No one knows what you're thinking. No one knows what you're observing unless you communicate. So art opens up those channels of communication, because I force people to communicate in things that they're not necessarily comfortable talking about. And if you can talk about a painting that you've never seen before, when things get rough in your company, be the pilot who picks up the phone. And so it's the idea of encouraging communication, not just when times are good, but when there are troubles or there are problems to be solved, just communicate.
And you see impacts there? Like, do you ever measure, do you have any ways of measuring? And I don't mean this to be a trick question, but do you have ways of measuring kind of the difference that you make either within kind of a corporation or, you know, within like a government agencies or the medical fields? Is there like a promise of before and after, I guess?
You know, I did a test when I published my first book in 2016. My publisher wanted to know just what you did. You know, we only have anecdotal evidence. How do you know that your method is working? And so I did a test. I put a picture up. It was a photograph by JR, and it was a big mural in Brazil, in Rio. And I asked my participants to write four words to describe what they see. And I did it at the beginning of my session. I did it at the end. And I noticed the number of words that they used after the session. And I didn't say anything. I just put it up and said, you know, write a sentence. You know, first I said four words, and then I did four words. And then I said, write a sentence, write a sentence. And the sentences went on and on about the things that they noticed. And so in the very simplest way, I look at people's choice of words, how they choose to describe something. Did they become more objective? And then I looked at the depth of how they describe something. And the same work of art, beginning and end, changes dramatically. And so I think the idea, the other thing I do is my course is in multiple parts. And whenever I give the second part of the course, I spend the first 10 minutes asking how they used part one. How has their work changed from before they had the course, and how do they look at certain things? And that's where I get these wonderful examples of how looking at art has helped people change the way they do their jobs.
You talk about, I think you wrote an article about how not everything is art. And it makes me want to ask you, is art the one vehicle, not that is art the one vehicle, I'm sure you could find something else, but why is art a better vehicle than something else? Like, is there something about art that has special values or insights?
Yes, it's actually really quite simple. When you look at a work of art, everybody sees something. You can't look at a painting, and if I say, well, what do you see? You can't say to me, well, I don't know, because you're looking at something. So even if you say to me, I see 10 different colors, that's better than I don't know. And so what art does is it encourages a kind of what we call neuroplasticity, engages your brain. When you look at a work of art, your brain responds in a way that it doesn't to any other stimuli. And so as my colleagues in the intelligence world like to say, neurons that fire together, wire together. So when you're looking at a work of art and your brain engages in a certain activity, my hope is that when you're faced with some kind of dilemma or problem later on, your brain is going to call on having those neurons fire together again to help you solve the problem in a different way. And so art is so readily available. And I agree with you completely. Not everything is art. I mean, looking at a child's drawing on the refrigerator, well, it's really lovely. It's not a work of art, you know, that I would use, because a work of art that is in a museum or is done by an artist who has different training and exposure, it gives us more depth of conversation. It doesn't mean that we can't talk about the child's drawing on the refrigerator. Of course, we can talk about it. But I look at works of art, and I look to include works of art that will be conducive to substantive conversations that give the participants solid takeaways.
Thank you. We talked a little bit about meditation and spirituality already. And I guess in that continuation, what I want to know is, I can see very clearly from what you're talking about, how art as a vehicle to help people better observe and understand and communicate in professional world is helpful. And my next question, I suppose, is how does being able to see and observe connects, if at all, to us living better lives outside of the professional world? So here I'm moving a little bit to the I guess, happiness, well-being, mental health, sense of connection and belonging area.
Sure. It's about engagement.
Yeah.
What it comes down to is engagement. When you are looking at a work of art, I'm asking you to spend time with it. I'm asking you to go out of your comfort zone, to put your phone down, because whatever I'm looking for is not going to come from Alexa or Siri. It's about your eyes attached to your brain. And that is directly applicable to how we engage with our children and our relationships and our partners. If we start to notice subtle behavior changes in our children, and I always say what your children don't say to you is as important as what they do say. So I want these skills. If I had a dime for every time somebody came up to me after a session and said, you know, this is going to help me with my work, but oh my God, I think about how I haven't been listening to my wife or how I've been observing my relationship in a certain way for 20 years. This is changing how I see my relationships and how I'm going to engage in my world. And to me, that's more important than helping professionally, because if we can engage at a deeper level in our personal lives, that's going to transfer over to our professional lives. And so I'm asking people to engage in all levels. To one of my favorite things is to pause. The pause, you know, the pandemic has forced us to pause. The journalist Frank Bruni wrote a beautiful piece about the pause. And this is what he said: a pause is when passions cool, civility gets oxygen, and wisdom finds its wings. And that's what art forces us to do, or I force people to do when looking at art, just pause and look. And if we do that with our partners and our children and our friends, just pause and give it the time, what you're going to see and observe is going to be augmented immeasurably.
I like that a lot. I think that time and how we interact with the time, the limited amount of time that we have in life, regardless of our age, is very connected to, I don't know if this is a very basic thing to say, by the way, but it's so connected to our daily satisfaction, right? Because I mean, it's about being present again, kind of a classic thing to say. I think nobody does this anymore, but I think we still struggle so much, regardless of how learned we are, how many books we've read on meditation and positivity and whatnot. We know that being present is really the key to happiness, to well-being, to performance, even if we're talking about the professional world. But we suck at it, you know?
We do suck at it. And I'm going to tell you something that I don't usually tell people at the risk of TMI, because it's something in my own personal life that I do. And it gives me the opportunity to be present. But I find that my work looking at art and teaching people to look at work of art helps me tremendously. I am what's called a vigil volunteer. And what that means is I spend time with people who are actively dying, people who are in the last hours of their life. And frequently they're not responsive. And I do it because not everybody can have family members around. So if any, I give my time so that no one dies alone, basically. Wow. And it's not altruistic. It's not nearly as altruistic as it sounds, because it gives me the opportunity to be present for somebody else. And usually they are, you know, heavily medicated and non-responsive, but I believe that they know that I'm there. Because when we're dying, our body shuts down and our senses slowly go away, but our hearing remains. And there is a spiritual presence. As I said, I'm not religious, but I tell you this because I really don't tell too many people. I can't believe I'm saying this on a podcast, but my ability to look at art enables me to call on those same skills to be present for those people who can't communicate. And I sit with them as they're dying, because it's the ultimate in being present, not just for them, but for myself.
I think that's beautiful, and I'm really grateful that you were willing to share it with me. Thank you.
I share it with almost no one, which is kind of strange that I've done it on a podcast, but you asked me about engagement, and part of the reason I said it out loud is because there's a stigma about the dying, and everyone is born, and there's an equal inevitability that everyone dies, and nobody wants to talk about it. And I'm not saying that it's for everyone to sit with the dying. It's not, but I do it because no one's alone when they're born. And I don't think people should be alone when they die. And so the idea of presence and summoning our ability to observe and be present is not dependent on this. This doesn't matter when you're dying.
You're showing your phone to me right now.
I'm showing you my phone. Yes, I forgot. We're audio only. I'm showing you my phone. And so I do it for emphasis, because I see that when people are dying, they go out of this world the way we come in. Nobody comes into the world with a phone, and nobody goes out with a phone. And so, and I'm not saying I'm not dependent on my phone as everyone else is, but when we get out of that realm, which is something to bring it back to art, that art enables us to do, it makes us comfortable with being present in a different way. And so that's why I brought up being with people that are dying, because it's summoning those same skills. So I apologize if that's too much.
Not at all. It's not too much. And actually, you know, it's funny. It makes me think of the, I'm blanking on the word. Those artworks from, when they would have painted ahead of the vanities. There you go. It makes me think of like vanity painting.
Oh, vanitas. Yeah,
vanitas. Sorry. Les vanités in French. where people would, try to immortalize in time and therefore in art, because that is a static picture, the things that were meaningful to them and that represented their lives to the best. And so often it's belonging, because they have to have the physicality of it, but there's always a skull that represents death, and there's always a watch that represents time, and as you're telling
me, that's just gone out,
a candle that's just gone out, rotting fruit exactly.
Right.
And I mean, as you're telling me the story, I think about that, because I mean, that's all you can do, right? People think about also their heritage, and one of the ways of doing that is to leave art.
Absolutely. And what you're describing also in art history, when they talk about memento mori, you know, you have this beautiful configuration of objects with a limited life. There's a bowl of fruit that's rotting, as you said, there's a candle that's gone out, there's a skull. And here you have these beautiful narrative objects that remind us at how ephemeral life is and how frail it is. And so just the idea of recognizing that in art gives us a tool to think about recognizing that in life. And so art is applicable to so many things. And again, when I started to do this volunteering, I never thought for a minute that my work with art would carry over into it, but it has quite a bit in the training and understanding how to do it and actually sitting with the dying themselves.
I love that we've made all those connections, I think, starting from observing to talking about being present and the idea of meditation and contemplation that leads to the relationship with time, that leads to essentially life and death. And so how do we enjoy it whilst we have life, which is the idea of, I suppose, happiness. I think it's been a very this coherence there that I really love. So thank you for that, Amy.
I'm glad we were able to connect those threads. Sometimes you don't know those until you start talking, right?
Or until the end, you know, which is also good. So to end, I have a few essentially fire questions. So those are questions that you answer either by one word or by yes or no. And most important of all, don't think too much about it. Okay. Are you ready?
I'm ready to go.
What's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen?
It's a good question. Being in total darkness in the desert. I've never been, because I'm always in cities, and being in the desert at night, no human lights around me, was spectacular.
Amazing. Yeah. A book that changed your life?
Most recently, a book called The Boys in the Boat. And it's about the underdog, and it's about the power of collaboration and understanding the strengths and weaknesses of those around us.
If you were an artist, what type of artist would you be?
I would be a painter if I could.
Do you believe in God?
Yes.
In one word, what is art for?
It's going to be two words. To see.
To see. I love that. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lovely conversation.
Thanks for listening, everybody. I do hope, as usual, that you enjoyed it. And if you did, it would be so wonderful if you could let me know by leaving a review on Apple Podcast or really wherever you're listening. That would be a huge help. Otherwise, I will speak to you in 2 weeks' time. Bye.